Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to the Caged In podcast, you bullshit artist.
Hello and welcome to Caged In, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. We are here for a very special Caged In conversation this week with the director of the Lego Batman movie, The Tomorrow War, and the brand spanking new Nicolas Cage film, Renfield. It is, of course, Chris McKay. This was a fantastic conversation I had with him about all things Renfield, all things Nicolas Cage. This conversation basically divulged into a Nicolas Cage kind of nerd out, which is something I am prone to do here. So was very happy that it got to that place. And Chris was an absolute gent. This is a nice, hefty 45-minute conversation about all things, as I said, Renfield, and most importantly, for my son, at least, and maybe some of you listening out there, we get the closest to the definitive answer of how many Lego bricks it took to make the Lego Batman movie. So, oh, exciting, exciting stuff. So, yeah, without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Chris McKay. Whoa. One last thing before we get into this episode. Chris McKay does a massive spoiler for this film. So if you have not seen it, when you hear the following noise, just skip 15 seconds and you'll be in the all clear and ready to go. Now, enjoy my conversation with Chris McKay. So I'm joined on the podcast today by the director of Renfield, Chris McKay. How are you today, Chris?
I'm doing good. How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm very well. I got to see the film a couple of days ago, and I've just got to commend you on the kind of tightrope act of kind of balancing the tonal shifts of comedy, horror, and heart. Like, How does it feel? Obviously, what, it's like a year out since you wrapped filming. Like, how has that time in between been trying to find that kind of balance for you with this film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was fortunate. Obviously, it starts with a really good script. And when you hire Nick Holt and Nick Cage to do these performances, that you're kind of spoiled for choices as far as that goes. I mean, you know, the doing a horror comedy is, you know, there's very few good ones. And so we kind of knew that there was going to be a challenge, but I just thought, you know, this idea of like seeing Dracula through the lens of his assistant, through the lens of a codependent relationship with a toxic narcissist boss from hell, played by Nicolas Cage, as a you know, kind of rock and roll Dracula, that seemed like a lot of fun. And, seemed like the, you know, like I'm always looking for something that's like original and new and at least takes like at least a fresh spin on something. And so in a world where you could have just done a regular Dracula movie, to do one, yeah, through this lens of his assistant just felt like, you know, felt like something that's like really special. And I was really, really happy to work with Cage and work with Holt because they're just wonderful actors and really giving and game.
Well, I'm really interested to know where your kind of origins for your love of horror kind of come from? Because from looking at like your previous work, like even going back as far as Robot Chicken or even the Lego Batman, you've kind of peppered Dracula in throughout those projects. Like, So what were the kind of movies you would have watched as a kid that kind of got you into horror?
Probably the first horror movies I saw actually were the Hammer horror movies from the 50s and 60s. So when I was a kid, this TV station, I grew up in Chicago, and this TV station would play a block of movies every week, and they usually were on a theme. So you do Universal Monsters Week or King Kong Week, or in this case, Hammer Week, so I saw Horror of Dracula. I saw the Oliver Reed, werewolf movie, especially doing Frankenstein, all that kind of thing. And so that's probably like the first stuff that I got to see, where I got to see these characters, because I don't think they played the Universal stuff till later. So I saw the Hammer stuff first, and obviously it was in color, and it was these beautiful sets. And I remember the Horror of Dracula, specifically the ending, which we try to mimic a little bit of in our movie, because I wanted the beginning of our movie to feel like the third act of somebody else's Dracula movie. So the Horror of Dracula ends with Peter Cushing running across this table, leaping for the drapes, pulling the drapes down and having the sunlight hit Dracula, and then Dracula melting and, into this puppet, this little fakey looking puppet that they did, which was, we were obviously very inspired by in our movie, because we do the same sort of thing where the vampire hunter shoots out the drapes, and the drapes fall and Dracula goes on fire. And then you get to see sort of a puppet version of Dracula there as he's destroyed. And that kind of starts, that hopefully that's the signal of the audience that, hey, look, this is where Dracula's story in these movies kind of ends, and where Renfield's story kind of takes over. And that's kind of, why we started like that. But obviously it's drawing on these films that meant something to me as a kid.
Obviously you evoke the 1931 Todd Browning film. Was there like an element of trepidation with that, or were you kind of like all gung-ho to be like, we want to pay tribute to this and kind of have it there in the DNA? Because obviously, like you kind of superimpose Cage and Hulk's faces into that movie as well. So like, it's not just referencing it; it's like we're fully showing, we're retconning that stuff almost.
I mean, I wanted to find as many ways to show love to these old movies as I could, but obviously not in a way where it's like bogging down the narrative or whatever. And so whenever I could throw an Easter egg in, I would. And in this particular case, I also wanted there to be a real history with Holt and Cage as Renfield and Dracula. And by combining our heroes, by compositing our heroes into the, staircase scene in the Todd Browning movie, and putting Cage up on the staircase, that image that we've all, whether you've seen the movies or not, you've seen that image somewhere, whether it's been parodied in Family Guy or Simpsons or a poster or something, or in a montage of clips of things, you've seen that thing. I am Dracula. And that, just to me, there was a great way to do an homage, but it was also a great way of creating a real relationship that the audience can feel, because again, maybe this is part of our collective unconscious or pop culture, and you just kind of like feel that these guys have been together, the oldness and graininess of the footage and the way it's sort of shot, these angles that people are using, something like that, just kind of creates a history, shared history with these guys. And that was what was important to me about it, really, at the end of the day.
It played so well in the screening I was in, just like the sudden change of aspect ratio. And obviously, like for the silly literate, it was like a great kind of like moment of, they're doing it. And it's kind of like, it's a real ballsy move. Speaking of like ballsy moves, obviously this film, I think you could say it's quite ballsy. So like, when you first saw the script, what kind of leapt out to you? Was there something ballsy in it that kind of grabbed you and said, oh, I want to direct this?
Yeah. The fact that they weren't just doing, you know, another Dracula movie where, you know, that we've all seen done a million times, and even the movies that aren't about Dracula that sort of take, you know, some of the beats from Dracula, the original Dracula story. The fact that they were just doing, you know, Cage when he read, he's like, this is really brave that these guys are going to do a movie like this. And I think it was just, the fact that they're going to, you know, the Universal was going to let us make a movie about Dracula, but through the lens of his assistant, it's going to be about codependency, and it's going to, you know, had what I thought, you know, at least what I, you know, it's not all in there in the script, but what felt like splatstick humor, mm-hmm. you know, that there was that. And that got me really excited, because I'm a big, like, Sam Raimi and early Peter Jackson fan, you know, of Evil Dead 2 and Dead mm-hmm. Alive and that sort of thing. So the idea that you could do something like that with a studio budget, or, you know, like what do for an R-rated movie, that seemed like a lot of fun. And being able to play with a color palette, because obviously this movie is, because it's a horror comedy, and because modern, you know, horror comedies that you can't do, like, I don't think, you know, you can't do like straight parody. You can't do mm-hmm. the Dracula Dead and Loving It version anymore, or any of that sort of thing. You kind of have to ground this in a world that still feels like that world. Cause I think I love those movies, Airplane and Naked Gun and all that stuff, but I just don't think that, like, people are in a movie like this. I don't think that people are as willing to go there or invest in it. And I knew that you needed to kind of invest in these characters. If you're going to do a codependent relationship, you got to care. It can't be surface level. You got to kind of care about these guys. And that's why you got to hire Nick Holt. That's why you got to hire Nick Cage. That's why you got to ground it in something that feels quasi real at times, as much as you can make it feel real and earn. And I think the relationship between Nick and Nick, the Renfield and Dracula relationship, regardless of anything else in the movie, those two guys are really playing it. They're playing all the humor, but they're also playing all the drama and all of, you know, Dracula is truly, you know, he's manipulative. If one moment he's love bombing Renfield, the next minute he's menacing Renfield, the next minute he's gaslighting Renfield. And he's really truly playing a true narcissist, like going through all of the, you know, the lack of empathy, the grandiose feelings about himself. All that kind of thing is on display, and Cage does it brilliantly. And Holt is, you know, Holt's the guy you really root for, you know, no matter what he does, whether he's playing a war boy in Fury Road, or he's doing Romeo and Juliet, or he's playing, in The Great, he's unafraid to be unlikable or weird or strange or flirt with unlikability. But at the same time, he's so charming and so vulnerable that you want to follow him, and audiences want to root for him. And this is a movie that's you got to root for this guy. You know, he ends the movie, you know, I don't know if this is coming out before the movie that comes out or not, but he ends the movie, reciting his affirmations while punching Dracula in the fucking face with Dracula fang hands, like some sort of weirdo Wolverine thing. Like, you know, the movie could do that. Hopefully we earn that. That's the thing that's the most exciting, you know, for me. That's what excited me about the script.
Well, because I read in Total Film Magazine that you had said about casting Renfield that you kind of needed somebody, like you said, who could capture that vulnerability but can still get weird. Was it a tough road to find your Renfield, or was it quite easy to fall on Nicholas Holt?
Well, I met Nick Holt once before this for a different movie, and I really liked meeting him, and I was fascinated with his career. And when I read this script, my only thought was, this movie doesn't work unless we get Nick Holt. I didn't see anybody else for the role. I was just like, this is the guy that this movie, you know, lives or dies by whether or not we can cast this guy. Cause there's Nick Holt, and then for this kind of thing, and then not a lot of other people. And so, on the one hand, it was very easy because I just saw that one guy and that's who I wanted. And on the other hand, it's hard because obviously, like, he's a busy guy and doing a lot of things. And can you make his schedule work with some other, you know, A-list actors scheduled to get to be Dracula? And fortunately, both Cage and Holt and Awkwafina's character and Awkwafina's schedules worked out. So yeah, so we're really lucky that we were able to get everybody and that, you know, we're able to make it work.
Amazing. I'm really interested to know what that first meeting with Nicolas Cage was like. Obviously, like, yeah, I'm a massive fan. In the kind of press for this, I had a carrot dangled to me that I possibly could have interviewed him, and it was kind of like that feeling alone was like, oh yeah. My God. So what is it like for you? Obviously, you get to meet kind of actors all the time and stuff like that, but like there is a certain gravitas to Cage. I'm not just saying that as a fan. Like, he kind of feels like an old school movie star in a way. What was that initial meeting like with him?
No, he is a movie star. Like, he is an old school movie star. Like, he's like, so, and there's very few of those people. I mean, I get nervous around people all the time. Like, that's like, you know, that's like, you know, for me, like, you know, because you're meeting your heroes, right? And Cage was somebody like I grew up with, from raising Arizona and Peggy Sue Got Married and Moonstruck and all of that stuff. Like, you know, those were movies that were, big, movies. And then into, The Rock and Con Air and Kiss of Death and all the stuff he was doing, Red Rock West. And, just like amazing performance. And he's a guy that I would go see his movies because he's in it. Mm-hmm. Like, Kiss of Death, maybe like, the David Caruso or the Richard Price, I think, wrote the script, stuff like that. But, it was Cage that I want to see because everyone was talking about. He puts in this really physical performance, and he's like, and he's so great because, again, talk about vulnerability. Like, he plays this, and he's really jacked up in that movie. That's like in the phase of his life where he's like getting super jacked up for movies. And at the same time, he's got this fucking, puffer. Yeah. He's puffer all the time. So he's playing this really dangerous, and it's a remake, and Richard Widmark played the original version of it. But he plays this really guy who's really scary. And at the same time, he's one breath away from fucking dying, and he's got everything tougher with him at all times. It's really a great performance. And that's another movie where it's like, that movie's worth seeing just to see Cage.
Yeah.
What do you think about anything else? And, it's Cage is so good in that movie.
Not many movies do you get to say you can see Nicolas Cage bench press a stripper as well.
Bench press a stripper, exactly. He's like bench pressing a stripper in that movie. And that angle too, they had down on him while he's moving that out for his cameras. But yeah, like that to me, is so, he's just this guy who's, we have a deep love for, and he's done all of these different things. Like, he's played every kind of, avant-garde stuff to very real things. And he wins an Oscar and adaptation and just all the stuff that he's done. He's just had this amazing career. It could happen to you. I find him so charming. Yeah. And it could happen to you. And it's he's not doing like, he's just playing a cop. It's so not anything that you would think about with Nick Cage, but he's just so good in it. And he's just so charming, and he's got chemistry. Like, he has chemistry with all the other actors, but he's got chemistry with the camera. Like, he's just a fucking movie star. And yet he's the nicest person you'll ever meet. Like, he's just so genuine and real, like real all the time. And that's, and the thing, like you were asking, I think your question started with like, what's it like to, the first conversation? It's like, the first conversation I had with him was like, I think it was over a Zoom, but I don't think there was picture. I think it was just over audio. And we were just talking about the script, and he was so enthusiastic. And, and that's why he was on set. He's got this childlike enthusiasm. He's full of joy. He just loves making movies, loves being on set. After all these movies that he's been in, he shows up every day on set, even with the, 4 hours of makeup, and he's at 20 pounds. He had body makeup, he had everything on him, 20 pounds of makeup that he has to sit in a chair for 4 hours and do, and then come on and work out 10 hour, 12 hour a day. And then go take it off. So it's like, and again, we're not curing cancer or anything when we're doing this stuff, but it's just like somebody that's that level in a world where the ego, it's so easy to get into an ego place, when you're getting chauffeured around and all this stuff, and people, are trying to take care of it. So easy for people to get, just get twisted up about like what's real and what's not real. And here's this guy who's just like, he just wants to play and have fun. Exactly. And just create. And it's just, it's a, like I said, it's a joy to be around, and it's inspiring to be around. Both Holt and I were just like, every day was like, wow, we're just fucking inspired to work with this guy.
Well, everyone I've spoke to who's ever worked with him always says that, like, when he comes to set, he kind of knows the script back to front and kind of, yeah. Do you know what I mean? He could do the lines
any which way.
But what kind of character quirks did he bring to Dracula? What did Dracula look like before Nick was cast? And what did he bring to the role?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he starts with a costume. It starts with what he's wearing. And, you know, he was very, he had great ideas about costuming. He's got great ideas about everything. He had great ideas about script notes and line changes and things like that, word changes. But it started with the costuming. It started with Lisa LaVos, who was another great partner. Lisa's amazing. And she and Cage started working on the costuming, started working on the rings. Cage was really big on the rings and wanted like a full set of rings and had some very specific ideas about what should be in some of the rings and stuff like that. And that was really cool. And he also wanted certain fabrics and stuff like that. Like, we play a lot of the velvet and the rhinestones and that sort of thing. And we were also, you know, I mean, that was the stuff that Cage brought to the table. But the stuff that we had talked about before Cage showed up was, you know, synthesizing some of the Bela Lugosi stuff with the Christopher Lee stuff with very modern cuts. And, you know, cut, as far as the shape and cut, but also like the collaring, like bring like a really high, a very regal collar, like something you'd see, like, you know, maybe more French cut and that kind of thing. And so there's lots of that stuff that kind of came. And so it was just once Cage came on board of synthesizing that, Christian Tinsley with the special makeup effects, you know, we talked a lot about, like, you know, at one point we were talking about like facial hair, because, you know, the original Bram Stoker, as written, had, you know, Dracula had a mustache and all that kind of thing. It's meant to be very Eastern European. I mean, really, the story of Dracula was about sort of the fears of Eastern European immigration into London.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's what sort of like the original text was kind of about. And sometimes that stuff is brought out a little bit more in different movies, but Dracula sort of stood for something. And I thought, oh yeah, what if he had a beard and stuff like that. So we were playing around with stuff like, you know, that kind of thing. But ultimately, like, we settled on this thing. Like, once we saw Cage and he was clean shaven, we did the white base paint and the Widow's Peak wig and stuff like that. Like, it all came together in a really, really great way. And it just looks so good. And Christian did such a nice job with that. And Christian and Cage worked together a lot on what the makeup, what the eyebrows would feel like and that kind of thing. And yeah, it was just a really great team collaboration. But you know, it's all based on, like, what, you know, once Cage got cast, it's just like, people just got really excited. Like, there's just a lot of excitement when he was cast in this movie, as far as like through the crew. It's just like, and I'd been on the movie for like a couple months before we cast Cage. And it's just like, it just sent a shockwave through everybody, and everybody's game just like stepped up, and they were just like, you know, on pins and needles. Like, you know, with excitement, like when that first camera test, when we had him in the full makeup and costume, and you get him in front of the camera. And I had all these candles, you know, on set for the camera test, and all the smoke, and it was playing like the score from Coppola's Dracula as he entered, you know what I mean? As he entered the room before he even got on camera. And it just sets the tone, and people just got like really psyched about making the movie. And that was a great, you know, kind of coalescing of everybody's, like, you know, the all of their, you know, hopes and dreams for this movie suddenly just like got kicked up a notch.
Yeah, in the way that the kind of this film, like, almost like as a bookend with Todd Browning's film, it's almost like a weird bookending with, in kind of Cage's like rise, we get Vampire's Kiss, and that as he's kind of like, I don't know, on this kind of new wave, kind of coming out of like what some people, obviously you don't have to comment on this, but what some people would call a slump. Like, I don't particularly believe that anyway, but kind of what you read on the internet, it's kind of great to see this mirroring that, like, it feels like a role that was born to play, right? Because we've got, yeah, we have Vampire's Kiss. We have the fact that he produced Shadow of the Vampire and was going to play, was going to play the Willem Dafoe role at one point. And yeah, it's kind of the casting. As soon as I saw it, I was like, "This makes complete sense."
So Cage, when he was really young, his father played the movie Nosferatu for him when he was 5 years old. And so Cage saw the movie and Kevin and Dr. Caligari when he was 5 years old. And that made obviously a huge impression on him. Mm-hmm. That kind of silent movie acting, that kind of creepiness of all that. But that's, you know, I think that started his love of horror movies. It started his love of, you know, his love of movies in general. You know, and again, you see a lot of the way Cage uses body. He really uses like his hands and things in a way. And that a lot of that can be drawn back to, you know, to Kevin and Dr. Caligari and Max Schreck and Nosferatu.
Amazing. So another thing with this film as well is I guess a lot of people will be shocked at how kind of gruesome and violent it was. And you kind of mentioned about that kind of slapstick horror, which I kind of reveled in. Anytime there was kind of something gruesome, I was like, I'm loving this. And I'm always fascinated about the kind of, especially with like action, like set pieces and stuff like that. Like, how do you go about it? Is it like, do you storyboard it? Like, yeah, what's the kind of practicalities to stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it starts with Chris Brewster, who's our stunt coordinator and second unit director. It starts with him, and basically he does, and we go over the scene, we talk about like, kind of like what our, you know, my hopes and dreams are and what I think a scene, you know, needs. You know, action scene obviously needs a point and needs a, you know, goal and all that kind of thing. But I also said, look, there also has to be moments of, there's going to be moments of violence that we need, that are meant to be funny. And there just needs to be an overall tone of humor to the scene. There needs to be, you know, the action has to be brutal, because I like brutal action, but it also has to be funny. Mm-hmm. There has to be moments. It's either so brutal it's funny, or it just has like, you know, something that's inventive or whimsical. and so we studied, like, besides obviously the studying, you know, modern action scenes of John Wick or what have you, but also study like Jackie Chan, because there's no one funnier as far as doing action scenes than Jackie Chan. And then it was like looking at the splatstick stuff in an Evil Dead movie, Evil Dead 2 specifically, and the Dead Alive stuff that we talked about, and bringing, you know, bringing Tinsley in to it, Christian Tinsley, the special fake makeup guy. So Brewster would go off, he'd start to shoot something, block something together on, you know, like with the stunt team. Sometimes that we'd have access to the set early on, so he could do it there. Sometimes it's in a rehearsal space, but he'd go and he'd block all this stuff, add sound effects, add music, cut it together. And then we'd sit there and look at that. I'd go and maybe ask him to try one other thing, or I'd get the storyboard artist to draw some things. And then I would also, you know, show it to Christian Tinsley. And then we would start to kind of brainstorm some things like, can we add this here? Can we do a face rip? Can we do this or whatever? And he would then go off and do some tests and his thing, shoot those tests. I'd marry all this stuff together. So basically you have a picture and audio blueprint, animatic picture and audio blueprint. That's a little bit of pre-viz that kind of shows the stunts, shows a little bit of some of the action that, you know, as far as the whimsical action that we wanted, some of the splatstick stuff that we wanted from Tinsley. You put all that stuff together and it kind of helps you make your day, because now you've got a real solid blueprint. You know, what angles, because obviously with stunts, there's only certain angles that work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you're stacking punches. No one's hitting each other in the face or kicking each other in the chest, or rarely are you really doing that. You got to stack it so it plays. There's only certain angles that are going to work. So you kind of are starting to map out what your day looks like. And that's how you, and that's also where you get to play with tone. You get to figure out what music works and what doesn't. You get to figure out how long or short something's going to last. And whether or not you can kind of push it some more, because obviously you also want to try to, you know, kind of, you know, grow your ideas when you're doing this stuff. So when you're on set, you don't leave any money on the table. You can really go for it and get as much out of it as you can, and then bring it back and then post, you know, be able to kind of like massage it more.
Yeah, it seems like a real big part of this, like something that you're passionate about and you kind of see it in the film, is practical filmmaking. Is that something like, obviously, yeah, a lot of the effects look like, and I think I've seen footage as well, like some behind the scenes stuff, and it looks kind of gruey and real. How important was it to be kind of practical effects as much as possible?
I like shooting stuff practically. I mean, you know, even on something like Tomorrow War, where the aliens were for the most part, you know, had to be CG. I wanted us to be on as many practical sets and locations as possible, to have, you know, practical, you know, muzzle flash, you know, like real muzzle flash and that sort of thing. And same with Renfield, you know, where it's like, I like you know, to be in places where, you know, the, where we're blowing squibs and we're, you know, we're blowing, you know, gallons of blood and things like that. And, or cages in that makeup where it's like, yeah, some people would have just done that, put some dots on him and do a lot of that stuff. And later I wanted all that stuff to be real and tactile so that like, so the cage really feels the weight of this. And when he looks in the mirror, he doesn't see himself. He sees this monster, you know? And so as much as possible, I wanted all that stuff to be real. Cause I think it changes the performance. I think it changes it for the audience. Even if, you know, people think it looks fake or whatever, I don't, sometimes that's okay. I mean, especially in a movie like this, it can be kind of okay. Cause it's kind of, you know, it's meant to be a little over the top and it's meant to be homage to that sort of thing. I mean, that stuff's kind of fun. And I think that, you know, even the dumb puppet that we use in the beginning of the movie, I mean, it doesn't look, you know, real, but it's fun. It's fun. And it gets a laugh, you know, cause it's just sort of silly and, version of Dracula. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially when you have those kind of reference points of like Evil Dead 2 and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of claymation in the original of that. Like, like doesn't really stand up now, but we all love it as kind of like gory horror fans. Another thing I had to, really wanted to mention was the kind of set design and the lighting in this, because it's kind of like this, it really sets a tone to the movie. Like how early on did that come? Was that like, how paramount was that to the look of the film for you?
Yeah, I think there was like two things when I read the script that were reasons why I wanted to do the movie. One is to do a movie about codependent relationship between Dracula and Renfield. That was something that was, you know, like the story of this, you know, Renfield going through this redemptive arc. That was something that was really important. The second thing that was really important to me, and you know, they sort of thought if everything else goes wrong, like, you know, at least the movie will do this. And I wanted to try to imitate the art style of Basil Gogos. And Basil Gogos was this guy who did these paintings of the old Universal monsters. At the time that Basil Gogos came around, the Universal monsters had only been seen in black and white. So no one had ever seen them, what they looked like in color. Uh-huh. They'd just seen, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, you know, Wolfman, et cetera, in black and white. And Basil Gogos did these covers for Famous Monsters magazine, which is this old school magazine out here in the States. And he interpreted Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman in color with these really garish, really saturated colors. Mm. And for me, doing like a horror comedy and trying to differentiate it from, because you got to make it feel a little real, you know, for a modern audience, the movie has to feel real on some level. So I knew shooting wise, we weren't going to necessarily like ape like an old movie style for the whole movie. We could do a bit, you know, in the beginning to sort of go back to the Todd Browning movie, but the movie has to feel like a modern movie. And so I wanted to shoot it like a Tony Scott movie as much as possible. But by doing it with the color scheme and saturation of these Basil Gogos paintings. So that's why, you know, everyone's got kind of the colors are really saturated and they're sort of lit sometimes either top down or this underlit stuff and things like that with really big color. And Alec Hammond, the production designer, is an incredible artist and really great partner. And he built all those sets. He and his team, Chris Crane, a bunch of really great guys and girls came in and just did some amazing stuff. The set decorating team did incredible stuff with all the sets, Gary Tours on the props. They built all this wonderful stuff and sets that we could light from. I like practical lighting, talk about practical effects. I like practical lighting and sets as much as possible. I don't want to bring a lot of lights in. I want to be able to have the camera go around and find stuff where we can. So try to do as little lighting as possible, try to do everything as practically as possible. So that Coda meeting, that set's entirely lit from above. And some things outside the windows, and that's it. There's very little. Sometimes Andy and the guys would bring in just like a little light next to the camera. We're doing close-ups and stuff like that, like a little soft light to create a little more beauty. But other than that, everything's lit from above because I wanted it to feel like what it'd feel like if you're in one of those you know self-help meetings. It's just like top lighting, the gymnasium coming down on you. He's shaped it. It's shaped so that it does a certain thing and it falls off in a beautiful way. So it's not like it's like he just threw something up. It's shaped in a really delicate way. And then Dave Cole, who was our colorist, came in and did really, really fine, delicate work to highlight the colors, to carve off some of the, you know, lighting and things like that and really shape it some more. So it's all these teams, all these different departments coming in and doing this really great work costuming. Lisa's costumes obviously pitch a certain color and things like that in order to get a certain amount of saturation and life out of the costumes. So really, really great team.
It looks fantastic. I wanted to know as well, like, how much has kind of your work in animation kind of informed like your live action filmmaking? Do you feel like do either inform the other or what are the similarities and differences?
Absolutely. Like especially when we're talking about that thing, when we're talking about animatics, I mean, when you're doing animation, you're building these, you're building storyboards that then become these, previs, reels and these layout reels. And so you are building these things so that one, storyboards is helping the next department see, how they want it blocked. And then that department helps the animation team see it. And then that helps the lighting team. So you are building these things. And so, to me, that's a great way to kind of get a first take at what your story is doing and try to figure out if you're getting the tone or not, or if you can achieve, what more you can get out of the tone if possible. So that's, I always try to bring in some of these animation tools because I think every filmmaker should do an animated movie, do a short film, do something, because it's storytelling in slow motion, and you get to figure out exactly, sometimes what your story and character needs, and animation is really great. Because you're spending, cheap animation, there's very, these days that, you're spending $1 million a minute probably on an animated movie, something like that. So you got to really make sure it's jam packed with story and character information. And so as much as I can try to get as much story and character out in a live action thing, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm always trying to fill the frame with information as much as humanly possible.
You talk about filling the frame there. I noticed whilst watching this, you kind of had a couple of actors who people may notice. So Caroline Williams and William Ragsdale. Were they purposely popped in there for obviously their kind of horror credentials? Yeah.
Look, if it had been up to me, I would have cast, way more. every part would have been filled with someone from a horror movie that meant something to me. Yeah, Caroline Williams of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and a bunch of other movies. She's wonderful and a lot of fun to work with. And I really wanted to do something with her. And I actually looked at her for Tomorrow War at one point because I wanted her to be part of the Army of the Ordinary in Tomorrow War. And William Ragsdale, obviously the Fright Night connection, but he's also like, he did Justified he's been doing, I think he was on the Ozark or something like that where I saw him. He's done some really great stuff. He's still like a really fine actor. And I just because he was, in Fright Night and, now he's sort of playing the Roddy McDowell role, I guess. This movie, he's playing the vampire hunter as opposed to the, the kid who sees the rear window vampire situation. But he's awesome. He was great.
Amazing, amazing. So what I'm fascinated about is obviously throughout your career, you've kind of played in these amazing sandboxes, not just in kind of IP. Obviously, you've done some groundbreaking animation. You did a sci-fi action movie and now a horror comedy. Is there which all kind of, especially with the latter two, feel like genres that, aren't really that served that much, any other genres that you'd like to tackle in the future that you kind of haven't yet?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking for something new. I think that's the thing, is I'm looking for something that's going to be, whether it's new that's out there or new that's original, obviously, with Lego Batman, there's an IP there, but the thing that was super hooky for me was, you're gonna tell Batman story in a way that no one else can tell it. You're gonna actually solve Batman's problem, which there's no upside to that in a live action Batman movie, because it sort of makes sequels tough. But to be able to do a story where you actually kind of get into Batman's, stuff and solve it, maybe that seemed really appealing. Tomorrow Wars, like I said, military sci-fi action movie that we don't do a lot of, but are such a fun genre. But it's hard, it's a father and daughter story, and that's what was really appealing. It's I'm looking for genre stuff that has an emotional human component to it, Dracula Renfield, Codependency, and that sort of thing. Even in a sort of a you know, big silly comedy with, you know, splatstick humor and action, that there can be, you know, something about codependency in the movie. I thought that, you know, to me, that's what it was appealing. So that's probably what I'm looking for. You know, I would love to do like a movie that takes place in outer space or another planet. I think that would be a lot of fun. Like, that's something I'm sort of actively looking for. I also really like fantasy, and there's a couple of books that I've been reading that I'd love to turn into a movie. And then kind of like, I mean, I know this sounds like all over the place, but like, you know, there's a series of I'm a big James Ellroy fan and a big sort of like what I would call like, you know, film noir, mm-hmm. you know, but not film noir type novels and that world. And there's a couple of authors whose books I really love that I'd like to turn into a movie or turn their, you know, book series into a TV show or something like that. So there's still those things, those are some things along the way that I love to sink my teeth into.
Amazing. I have two quick questions for you to wrap up. One of them I'd be remiss not to ask you, because I recently watched Lego Batman again for I don't know how many times I've watched it with my four-year-old son. He's kind of besotted by it. And on the last rewatch, I told him I was going to be speaking to you. And I said, do you have any questions about this film? He had one solitary question for you, Chris, which is, how many Lego bricks did it take to make that film?
I used to have that answer. Hold on. I used to have that answer, and I was obviously in the millions. I used to have the exact answer, but let's just say it was like, you know, 1.5 million Lego bricks or something like that. But it's a lot, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we do at Animal Logic, where we made the movie in Sydney. You know, there are bricks, individually made bricks, it's CG that we make and age and stuff like that, so that the movie feels like it feels tactile. Amazing. Like that. So the guys work really hard to make that stuff feel real.
Amazing. Well, yeah, you would have made a little four-year-old's day with that answer. My final question is, I always ask my guests on this podcast as a closing question. Obviously, you've got a horse in the race with this, but what is your favorite Nicolas Cage movie? Renfield can't count.
Renfield can't count. That's a really good question. I mean, I really liked The Rock. I think he's so good in that movie. He and Sean Connery are so much fun. I think all the actors are having a good time. I think it's the Michael Bay's best movie. It's most accessible and fun movie. Cage's performance and Adaptation as mm-hmm. the two brothers just tickles me every time I watch it. Yeah. I just love it so much. I just love watching him in that movie. He's so good in both roles. I just, and so endearing. I just really, you know, no matter what anybody thinks of that movie, which I think is a great movie, I just, he is so watchable in that movie. I love it. What's your answer?
It changes all the time. Red Rock West's got a special place in my heart.
Red Rock West is a solid movie. That's Jacked Up Cage. That's when he's in the, you know, Jacked Up days. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Chris,
he's still a solid guy. Like, we were on set one day and I was patting him or kind of, you put my hand on his shoulder to guide him over here. And he's still built. Like, he's still a really solid guy. I was really surprised that he's like, he still works out. So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time, Chris. And again, congratulations on Renfield.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Did you like the movie? Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Yeah. It was, yeah. I saw it on Tuesday. So yeah, one of the film journalists there, I kind of know him from doing the podcast, and he said, I've got to sit next to you. He's like, because how often do you get to sit next to, like, a guy who's like so kind of into the Cage, like, oeuvre, that you get to experience a film with them. So yeah, I loved it. I can't wait to watch it again. Obviously, as soon as it's kind of out here in cinemas, I'll be watching it next Friday.
That's cool. Well, thank you for reaching out to do this. This is a wonderful. Yeah,
thank you, man. Thank you so much, Chris. Cheers.
Good talking to you. Take care.
Bye. There we have it, guys. Chris McKay. Hopefully by now, you have all seen Renfield. I'm dying to know what you think about it. Please do let me know. You can find me on all the socials at Caged In Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. Yeah, well, let's have a little chat. Let's talk about Renfield. As I said, I'm going to cover this film at a later date when I can kind of give it the full Caged In treatment instead of something a little bit more rushed. You would have heard that if you'd listened to the previous episode on this feed. If you're listening to this right now, day of release, or in the future, look at the episode below this. And it was a conversation I had with the star of this film, Nicholas Hoult, which is absolutely mind-boggling that happened. It's kind of absolutely blows my mind that I got to do that. And the time I recorded the kind of intro and outro for that episode, I was like, I think I was still in the shock of doing it. Like, I kind of came out of it and chatting to people I knew who knew that I was doing it, and they're like, how did it go? And I was like, you know what, I have no actual idea. I felt like in the moment that just my ears were a whooshing sound, and then I was like, I'll just ask my next question when he stops talking. And I feel like if I'd had more time, classic, I would have done a lot better. Like, I feel like my unique selling point is you warm to me. And I'm not sure if I'm instantly somebody who is appealing. Maybe not. Maybe you can let me know, guys, if that is the case. So as for next week here on the pod, I've got a great conversation coming up with a guy called Jason Zenowick, who has a Nicolas Cage Dracula tattoo. I'm not sure if you might have seen this on socials. It kind of got a bit buzzy, got a bit like viral. At the Overlook Festival, he got invited on stage by Nicolas Cage to show off his tattoo. And he then got his leg signed and then that tattooed underneath the tattoo of Nicolas Cage as Dracula. And we talk about his whole journey, how he got to that place, being on that stage. It's a fun, wild journey. We get into stuff about fandom. We even talk about science, because Jason is a science teacher. So it was an amazing conversation and a really lovely guy. And it's conversations like that and that are just as important to me as the ones like with Nicholas Hoult, because it's the fandoms, right? Like, these films almost don't exist without nice, passionate fans. We're not talking about the toxic fandom. That's a whole different conversation. We're talking about nice, reasonable people who like the films and kind of go out and support actors that they love. And yeah, Jason is one of them. And he's kind of a man after my own heart. And we kind of get into it. So yes, do stick around and listen to that one next week. I know for some people, like, they go, oh, don't know who the person is or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, well, they're not talking about a film. Who is this guy? Trust me, it's a really fun conversation and you won't want to miss it. If you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please feel free to head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where you can get a little bit of bonus content for a little bit of money. You give us more money, I'll shake my booty until it falls off. So yeah, do that. Or head on over to tpublic.com/cagedinpod or cagedinpod.etsy.com to grab one of our brand new t-shirts. Got a few designs up on Etsy. There's two designs up on Etsy at the moment, and there's five designs up on tpublic. I am meaning to put the other designs up on Etsy as well. And yeah, tpublic, if you're in the US, please order from there. It's just much lower shipping. If you're in the UK, order from Etsy. It works out a better deal for you. Works out like slightly better deals. It just makes it nice and easy for everyone in that way. It's kind of, yeah, you get your t-shirts in a timely fashion without paying ridiculous money on shipping, which is one thing I didn't want to do. That's why I kind of signed up to both of them, to make it nice and fair for you, the listeners. So if you don't want to part with any money, but would still like to support the podcast, you can do that by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If they have a system to rate and review, please do so. Leave 5 stars. And in your review, please do let me know what Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. And I'll be sure to read out the best ones.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here on the podcast. So as ever, guys, I've been Petros Patsalouis. I've been caged in. You've been amazing, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the PodCharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.